Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the roads policing unit before going into CID and child protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion. Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. This week we're going to be looking at the topic of police driving, police pursuits, and how it relates to the Road Traffic Act, in particular the offences of careless and dangerous driving. It's a topic that's been rolling on, I suppose, for years now. And the basic suggestion is that if you are to pursue a vehicle that's failing to stop and it's driving in a dangerous manner, a police officer, by definition, must also be driving in a dangerous manner. This has led to several attempted prosecutions of police officers over the years. And I think from memory, I don't think any of them have been successful. We're going to be looking at that and possible defences. And at present, there aren't any defences to dangerous driving. The only two that you could possibly use is automanism, which is like a sneeze or something that's caused perhaps an accident or a mechanical defect. We'll start with you, Steve, because you're a former force incident manager. You'll be well acquainted with the police pursuits and their management.
When I came into the force incident manager's role, the area of business which I wanted to really, really get to grips with, because I didn't have that much experience with, was police pursuits. The firearm side of it, obviously the learning could grow with the job and I could build on the previous firearms experience. But anybody who knows me knows that I'm not particularly a good driver. I could shoot straight, but not particularly a good driver. So I did get involved in pursuits as a PC and a sergeant, but it wasn't my bread and butter. It wasn't something that I actively sought out. What I do find, I always thought pursuits were riskier than firearms jobs. What we do in the firearms world is to try and minimise the risk to the public. More often than not, that's the top of the priority list. You can kind of do that by containing a house or containing a person on the street. And you can pull that barrier between the subject and the public by minimising the risk to the public. But the thing is with the pursuit is you've got a vehicle travelling at 50, 60, 80 miles an hour through a residential area. That bubble of hurt, as I call it, is moving really, really quickly. What you need that balance of, well, just because they're driving recklessly, we are not going to abandon it because word will get around and people will start driving recklessly because they know the police will abandon the pursuit. But you need to balance that against, we aren't just going to chase them come what may. So you need to really, really look at, for me, the proportionality side of it and why are we chasing this car? So murderers in a vehicle, that's going to be obviously more important than somebody who's got no MOT on the car. And are we going to accept levels of risk towards the police, the public, the subjects themselves, in able to catch those offenders? And when you do that hierarchical strategic list of priorities, arresting offenders, securing and preserving evidence is always below minimising the risk to the public and maximising safety to the police. It's finding that balance between actually catching bad people, but also what level of risk to the public is too much. And I think personally, this area of business has grown a lot over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And that can be in part because more recently, before he left, our old Deputy Chief Constable Terry Woods in Lancashire was the lead, the MPCC lead on driving standards, which included the training side of it as well. I do find that we have a more proportionate response to it. Can we do more? Yes, we can. But part of that doing more is protecting those people. Now, I authorised pursuits, or I did authorise pursuits, in ground commanders to carry on. But there's a lot of responsibility on them to be able to do that correctly. And they have to assess a lot of information process it, weigh up the risks and decide on proportionality very, very, very quickly. And like you said, officers will breach current road traffic laws. We need to be able to give them the protection to allow them to do it. Not in every circumstance, but in a very controlled, trained, proportionate way. And that's the other balance you need to get.
Well, for myself, I'm feeling in the room a little bit like Vanarama League 2 player in the presence of at least championship players. My colleagues on the podcast do have some experience in pursuits and the rest of it. I have one fail and one pass at the blue light course, which teaches you how to drive a standard police vehicle with the blue lights and the sirens, the blues and twos going. And I have the initial pursuit phase course under my belt, which was, you're not the fastest, Richard, but you're reasonably safe. There was the general conclusion on that. I come at it from a slightly broader view, which is obviously we're currently held to the standards of a careful and competent motorist rather than the standards of a trained police driver, which I suppose is the gist of the proposals going forward. We have this issue every time a police officer turns on the blues and twos when they're looking to make progress to an emergency deployment, a grade one deployment. Whether it's a pursuit, often it's not. The majority of the time when we turn on the blues and twos is because we're going to a thing and we want to get there quickly. And most of that goes on underneath the level of being directed by a force incident commander or a force incident manager. Every day, every shift, every hour business, somebody's firing at the blues and twos. I believe the most recent course, Celebra case, wasn't a pursuit. It was a police driver that was responding to a potential terrorist incident and was just looking to make progress to that incident and had fired on the blues and twos. Now, my concern over the driving and the standard of driving, again, declaring I have about 20-odd years in CID or one source or other, then was promoted onto uniform as a sergeant. And my inspector caught up with the fact that I hadn't done any qualification for blue light driving in 20 years. So I jumped into the car with the instructor, who was very good and failed me after about 10 minutes. Because I'd learned under a previous regime of police driver training, which was all about making progress. If people ended up on the pavement in their van, not a problem. You had to make progress through the traffic and you were forcing your way through. That's not the way we do it now, but it was possible for me to get into a police car with the level of training that I'd had 20 years ago. If it hadn't been picked up, I'd still be driving like a type 1 driver with a type 1 personality with rabies. It's a problem. So it's not just the pursuits. And the pursuits, for me, you are generally dealing with very well-trained officers in cars that are picked or selected for their ability to be performance driven and have the appropriate brakes and chassis and you know all the engineering about them that enables it to be driven safely at high speeds. When you're looking at regular police officers that are turning on the blues and twos trying to make to an emergency incident, you are looking at a high-end II-30 or you're looking at a Peugeot or whatever the standard vehicle is, and that's not a performance vehicle. You can make a case up at the top end, you know, when police drivers have got really good intensive training with good trainers in the appropriate vehicles. But most of these deployments going blues and twos, they're not that. It's standard police driving and trying to make progress to an incident. And should you be held perhaps to the standards of a careful and competent motorist in that? I think perhaps you should.
Obviously, there's your standard emergency response and then there's pursuits, which is a whole different kettle of fish. And Steve, you said, I like the phrase actually, it's a bubble of hers. I used to dread pursuits.
Your risk has to be mitigated by the training of the driver that's behind the wheel, two, what you might or might not know about that driver and what they'll do behind the wheel, and three, what they're driving, what the conditions are around them. It's difficult.
Let's look at the current situation as it stands for police drivers at the moment. They are exempt in law for certain things. One of them is speed and traffic light systems as well, traffic light controlled junctions. If a collision occurs, whether it be with the pursuing vehicle or the car that's been driven by a suspect, you know, the police officer, and not just the police officer that's driving in the pursuit, every other person that's involved with that may be culpable for a charge of dangerous driving. I know I've heard the passenger in a pursuing vehicle, police vehicle, has been looked at for dangerous driving. I've even heard of dispatchers being looked at for dangerous driving. The point I'm trying to make is there is no defence in law for a police driver at the moment for the standard of driving. There's been several cases that have gone to court, and it's on the judge's direction. And the judge can say to a jury, yes, this person's a police driver who was involved in a collision. I don't want your decision to be based on his police training. or her police training. It's just purely on that standard of a safe and competent driver. Other judges might say, perhaps you want to consider his training. And was he trained to a higher standard than a normal member of the public? But it is purely at the judge's discretion. There is no statutory defence to dangerous driving. And that puts a lot of police drivers off.
It does. And I've said it, I've heard it many times to me that, well, why should we go after this boss? Because we've got no support. We get support off you, of course. And I do try and give them as lot of top cover as I can when I authorise pursuits and consider the pursuit midway and then reauthorise it. But they're the person on the ground driving the vehicle who may commit careless or dangerous driving. I think it's ridiculous that a police officer asked to do these things in the pursuit of crime, detecting crime, is not afforded this protection. And I just want to go back to something you said there, Richard. Somebody going on what we call a grade one, a blue lights, get there within 15 minutes, emergency. Are you saying they shouldn't get the protection in law?
I'm saying that part of that course is the drive to arrive.
Yeah, I love that.
And
but you can't have them sat in traffic at a red light.
If there's nowhere for them to go,
yeah, I love.
Then you do, because I've done that and I've been that. But if they get to the point when they are driving recklessly to get to where they're going to, then I think there's a case for saying you hold them to the standards of a careful and competent driver. I get it with pursuit that you're looking generally at people that have undergone much better and intensive training, may well be more experienced at pursuit driving, will have better vehicles generally for that purpose. And I think pursuit's perhaps a different kettle of fish to and rarer than the blues and twos type driving that standard response bobbies do day in, day out. And if there's an amount of recklessness in that driving and they fall beyond, you know, behind the standards of a careful and competent driver in what they're doing, gone wrong side through red lights, because that's the what I've got, and you creep through and you're looking, but you don't keep the hammer down, if you will. No. It's a tricky balance, but there's got to be some accountability to the public for the way that we drive those vehicles.
Of course, yeah, and it needs to... We're a public body, aren't we? And we need to... It's use of force, and we need to review any use of force. But are you saying that we have a higher level of recklessness than Joe Public, or are we at the same level? Because I would suggest most grade ones driven safely, if you have gone offside on a nice big wide junction
Absolutely.
At a red light and crept through
yep.
and looked and gone,
yep.
I'd be quite happy with that.
So would I.
But
and we have exemptions in law, which Dave's alluded to, that we can go through those red lights.
Yeah,
And we can go wrong side. We can speed, you know, we can go above the speed limit. And those are all things that the law's already looked at and said, yeah, actually, police officers can do that.
We drive to the conditions, don't you? You drive to the conditions, and part of that conditions is the fact that it's dark and you can't really see. So you take some speed off a little bit. So that's where, because you were obviously Class 1 advanced, weren't you, Dave? Many years' experience on the motorway. And you would have naturally have slotted into that.
It's interesting, isn't it? I remember a case a few years ago, and it was a traffic sergeant that got a brand new traffic car. He was on nights. He decided to take it out for a spin on the motorway, not responding to everything. He just put it down as a training ride, and he blasted down the motorway. There's no other cars about, 140, whatever it went at. PSD, professional standards, got wind of it. They reviewed the footage from the car and charged him with dangerous driving. He went to court, he got acquitted, CPS appealed, a retrial, and I think he got an absolute discharge or a conditional discharge. But it was funny what the judge said in the first trial. He said, paraphrasing, so let me get this straight, he said, the force have trained you to drive at that speed and then have given you a vehicle in order for you to do so. And he was making the point, why are you in front of me?
Was it a training run, or was he just going for a black down the motorway? Because you're responding to something. Because you're trained to go at those speeds in that vehicle for a particular reason.
That's six and a half a dozen, isn't it? Probably.
I know. What jumps out at me there is, well, he's just putting the public unnecessary risk when he's not really going anywhere.
Well, he would be if there was public around, but there wasn't. That was the point. I mean, certainly, you know, when I've done advanced courses or refreshers, I have driven a lot faster on a training course than I have done operationally.
I can see the point for offering an enhanced level of legal protection to those trained officers that are involved in pursuit. And the thing that springs to mind immediately is a tactic, it's TPAC, where you're actually using your vehicles around another vehicle to bring it to a halt. And tactical contact is the other one where you're putting your vehicle into another vehicle to put it off the road, yeah, or to stop it.
Yeah, there's a whole range of tactics that we can do, including motorcycles now, which was a no-no up until a few years ago.
Yeah, there's been a few occasions with motorcycles where I've actually authorised a pursuit with a motorcycle because, for one reason or another, I needed it to stop. Again, you're thinking about the risk to the rider as well. I know they don't. We probably think more about the risk to the rider than they do. But if it's too often your helmet's on, very, very unlikely I'm going to authorise that pursuit. But what you get from that is people go and commit more crime on motorcycles and they don't have helmets on and stuff like that. But you've got to deal with the here and now, the risk to the person in front of you, as well as the strategic, well, how are we going to deal with this problem?
And we'll talk about what's a follow and what's a pursuit, because I know. But we'll go into that in a minute, and you'll know why we're all laughing. But
well, the helicopter cover has been affected, hasn't it? Shall we say? But
and they were godsend in a pursuit, the helicopter.
Yeah, and obviously I would have the downlink, you know, the video feed from the helicopter on in the channel on in the control room all the time. And sometimes we'd get downlink from an adjoining force on the pursuit. So we get, and then you try and find the radio channel and try and listen in on it, because, you know, you get a lot of learning, vicarious learning from listening to other pursuits and other commanders, especially in ground commanders. And you'd see this pursuit going on and the big, and the big police car's about 5 feet behind it.
Yeah.
And I'd be thinking, well, as soon as you got a helicopter up, back off, make it look like we've lost you. Hang on, I'm giving away tactics now, aren't I? And hopefully it'll pull over. Because if that big, big piece of metal that causes a lot of hurt stops and someone's out on foot, happy days.
Yeah.
Happy days. Because all that minimised risk and maximised safety of people is higher than secure and preserve evidence, detect, arrest offenders.
It's interesting. And I remember in one of our podcasts, we were talking about, I think it was arming police, wasn't it? And you said if you never had to pull your firearm out of the safe again, you'd be happy. And I felt the same about pursuits. I hated pursuits, absolutely hated them. I had colleagues that absolutely loved them, and each to their own, but there was so much risk involved in a pursuit, and you're right, you're managing, and you've got the national decision model to consider, and it's about proportionality, And then you've got to concentrate on your driving as well. And the analogy I use is a bit like a basic code one response is you're flying a plane, and a pursuit is you're flying a fighter jet about to launch missiles. It's a different way. It's a different way of driving. It's a different mindset, you know, and the system of car control in a pursuit, to be honest with you, just goes out the window, because you can't drive to the system when you're in a pursuit.
But that extra level of training that those people have need to stand scrutiny. I'm not saying that they don't, and I know from personal experience we had a really good relationship in the FIMS office with Motor Driving School. The trainers in there and the training that we got from a pursuit side of it, I really, really enjoyed. But I think nationally, and again, this is something that Terry Woods was obviously looking at and was a proper advocate of it, was standardising that. The way that firearms, as the College of Policing, they come around and get inspected and all the rest of it. Perhaps we need something like that with driver training, because you need that level of training akin to what a firearms officer would have with the refresher training and the scrutiny. Don't get me wrong, we've got the scrutiny with the pursuit panel that occurs every month from Chief Inspector level, where they will look at all the near misses, accidents, pursuits. All the pursuits get reviewed. Do have that checks and balances. So if I was running a pursuit and you were my driver on the ground, Dave, and we finished, even if it was like, great, we've done really, really good, there's a massive emphasis now on debriefing it. Don't just debrief the bad ones, debrief the good ones. And then it would be passed to another pursuit manager, at least inspector rank in the FIMS office, who would independently review that and then make recommendations to the pursuit panel. So it has its own internal scrutiny, but what we need is that external scrutiny and the professionalisation nationally of motor driving. And I get a feeling that if we do have that element, and it kind of alludes to it in the proposed legislation, if we get that element of, right, we are going to hold these people to this police level of recklessness and carelessness, we need to establish where that bar is, and we need to be really, really hot and open for scrutiny, like we would do under Article 2, to be able to say, right, this is the level of training, the same way that we do with firearms officers.
Well, that nicely brings us on, I suppose, to the consultation paper that the Home Office did, didn't they, about police driving? I think it was September 2017 that they put the consultation out on exactly that. What standard of driving should a police driver be held to? It's quite a lengthy document, but basically, of all the responses that they got back, 71%, I think, agreed that the exemption should be reviewed and amended, that police officers should be held to a different driving standard. And I think basically what they were saying was that perhaps they should be held against the driving standards of their policing peers. So that brings into the motor driving school, doesn't it? That brings its own problems, I suspect. You know, if you were to use that evidence, would it be from the same force or would it be from another force to keep it independent? And then it brings back to the training issues of everything will have to be standardised.
You don't get a fair and effective exemption without you having common national standard.
Yeah,
that's the top and bottom of it. And whose national standard do we have? How does that get done? Is it a college of policing job? You have different standards for advanced drivers and people that got the blue light course. You'd probably have to have that as well. Perhaps a complicated piece of work and revolve a lot of retraining in forces that are below that common standard wherever it's set. It's doable, but it has to be multi-layered. Again, you can't expect to judge a blue light driver by the standards of an advanced driver.
It's not just the standard of driving as well, it's mindset and decision making. When you're in a pursuit, Steve, you'll know it's like decision making is like bang, 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 there's plans coming in, there's decisions to be made, and literally it's happening so fast, and you're chasing a vehicle, and you've got to consider the public, and you've got to be safe. They talk about the red mist, don't they? And I always kind of took pursuits dispassionately, probably because I hated them so much, but I'm sure there'll be police drivers out there that will take it personally, shall we say, if somebody failed to stop, or the force incident manager told to discontinue the pursuit. And I've heard it on channel where being told to stop pursuing and then 30 seconds later or a minute later, yeah, one arrested. And you're thinking,
Yeah, that involves a phone call, that.
And we touched on it earlier, the follow.
Yeah, well, yes, we had a chuckle about that. The follow, yeah. When is a pursuit not a pursuit?
There is the level, isn't there, of IPP, which is initial pursuit phase course, which gives them, to a certain extent, the ability to pursue. And that's what when you get your response section officers in a Hyundai who are part of the initial pursuit phase. So they can't be doing tactics. They can't be, like, boxing the vehicle or anything like that. They can just basically do the initial phase. I get a lot of those where people try and stretch what a follow is, or even, yeah, I'm behind this vehicle now. It's just gone through a red light. It's left, left, left. It's right, right, right. It's left, left, left. I go, so you went through the red light as well then, did we? And I've found many times that, again, back to what you said, Dave, it's about mindset. And we have some great officers across the board who are really good at pursuits. Absolutely. And I take a lot from the tone and inflection in the voice about how they are. I had a rule as a firm, and it's something I tried to pass on to, especially those I trained up in the role, is to say, I never ask the same question three times. So the three questions I would ask you initially was, right, what's your skill set? Yeah. What's the DRA, what's the dynamic risk assessment? Yeah. And why are you after this car? Mm. So there's your proportionality test at the third one. Sometimes people will be giving you information and they miss out that they're in a suitable vehicle or whatever. And I'd ask again, okay, what's your skill set, please? Or I'd ask one of the other questions. And if I still didn't get it, abandoned. Because if we don't have that communication, I don't think you have clarity of mind to continue that pursuit.
One of the conditions of a pursuit is that you must have comms. No comms, no pursuit.
Oh, yeah, and that's been the worst ones I've had to abandon, where the radio signal's gone, they're in a low spot, and I can't communicate with them. They're giving a really good commentary, and I can't communicate, and I've had to abandon it. And you feel, well, you know, I trust the officers to do what they need to do, but I don't have the comms, so I have to abandon it. Or you try and, you know, use your car set because you're braking, or you try and get that comms, and you can't get it, it's fine. You've got to let it go. The other thing I will say about mindset is I've had high-risk pursuits, which I've allowed to go on, which I've reassessed and continue to authorise because of the tone of the officer who's on the ground, and I've abandoned medium risk for the opposite reason.
I was trying to dig out the pursuit policy that I used to have and I couldn't, but the opening paragraph is that pursuits are inherently high risk.
They are higher risk than normal driving. And again, it comes back to why we need that protection at a higher level. They're at higher risk than me and you driving home today, aren't they? Your high risks are wrong side, 80 mile an hour in 30, going through red lights without even looking.
Well, if a vehicle's gone contraflow, that's it. I back right off.
Back off from them, give them time and space. Let them make some positive decisions. Don't be pushing them down the road.
Does anybody know what a safe and competent driver is? I know the law says it will be obvious to a safe and competent driver.
Well, that allows the objective test, doesn't it?
I don't know. It's more subjective than objective to me.
The common group of people would look, your 12 good men and women would look at that and go, well, that's a bit. And what that does is cater for driving attitudes as time goes on, doesn't it?
Yes.
So that same group of 12 people, whoever, who are applying that objective test to your driving will change as time goes on.
Because going back to that argument, to pursue somebody that's driving dangerously, ergo, you must be driving dangerously yourself. And there is no exemption to that.
More often than not, I would suggest, yeah. But we're the cops. We've got to catch bad people. We've got to detect crime. Not at every cost, don't get me wrong. Proportionality has to be play key. But you know what? Sometimes we might have to drive fast. In that case with the... was it an ARV responding to that terrorist incident? And you get dangerous driver. Well, I'm sorry, but if I'm responding to a terrorist incident and I'm going to be one of the first there, so I'm not going to be the eighth car that arrived. So I'm going to be one of the first cars there. Folk are getting pushed off the road for me to get there because it's the risk factor, isn't it? And what pain and risk am I willing the public to accept for me to go to that scene and deal with it?
All true, but sitting at the bottom of all this, looking back at us, is drive to arrive.
Yes.
And you're no good to your terrorist victims if you're in a mangled chunk of X5 at the side of the road.
Do you think that some of this is the CPS not coming after cops? I'm not saying they're coming after cops, but really, really resistant to dropping common sense issues with involving the police because it looks bad. Looks as if they're covering up. They're in cahoots and they're covering up. That's why cops get an extra level of proportionality, an extra level of in the public interest, shall we say, because it's in the public interest to take cops to court because we're not covering up.
Well, I suppose maybe part of that thinking is that are we excusing bad driving on part of the police?
Yes, sometimes we'll have to.
In my blue light course, what was drummed into me was you can drive like a maniac, but you won't get there that much faster.
Yeah, but in a terrorist incident, I'll go back to that one, I want you there 20 seconds earlier but as the firearms commander.
They are so few and far between.
Yeah.
What we're talking about, I think, is the general, once the blues and twos goes on, you don't get there that much faster driving like a maniac is what was drummed into me on the course. Whether that's right or not, I don't know.
No,
that was
always
my mindset.
And the only difference it would make would be, in the scenario I painted, was if you're on the motorway and you are having to cover 30, 40 miles to back up a colleague or whatever, then...
But you're not driving like a maniac. I think we agree on that. You're driving...
I perhaps use colourful language, but...
To a higher standard.
And the other thing it brings into question is peer pressure as well, doesn't it? I mean, I've called off pursuits when I was ground commander. And, you get back to the office and it's like, well, why did you call that off? Because I wasn't happy with it for this, that and the other. Oh, well, I would have continued. Well, that's up to you.
Does that still happen?
I don't know because I haven't been on traffic for 7 years now, but it certainly did.
I can imagine, especially because it was that mindset of you're the better driver if you carry it on. You're the better driver if you get the bad person at the end of it. Come on, you've been able to accept and manage the risks that have been in front of you more, so it makes you a better driver.
I'm a year out, so on the peer pressure thing, there are officers, particularly those that are in initial pursuit phase trained, that are quite keen to get into a pursuit.
Yeah.
And they'll be happy when some senior officers are in the control room, because they're more likely to let it run for longer, and less happy when others are in the control room because they have a reputation for cutting pursuits short at an early stage.
Okay, well, like we say, the proposal is now to use the objective standard of a police peer driver in the future. this consultation goes back to 2017. They've been talking about it for years. There's still no indication as when this will be brought into law, so I wouldn't be holding our breath.
You need that level, don't you? You need that police level to be absolutely nailed on, and the training packages and the standard of driving has to be consistent nationwide, or else it'll just fall over, won't it? Because you'd be tested against your own standard, and if your own force isn't up to speed, it just falls over straight away.
And it's like anything in the police, isn't it? Go outside a policy, and then you're in a pretty vulnerable position, unless you can justify it.
Yeah, the old phrase, isn't it? You're the one gripping the rail. But many times, the powers and policy bubble on the NDM does allow you to step outside powers and policy, which, you know, I've done a few times, and receive the support to do so, but you have to be really, really clear in your decision-making and be able to articulate it.
It's doing the right thing.
It's finding the money to do it. It's going to cost a fortune. And even if you decide to do it tomorrow, how long would the College of Policing, if they were chosen to do it, if they survive policy exchange, how long would it take them to produce that national standards at the various levels of police driving? Yeah. You've got the consultation, then you've got the policy to write and draft, then you've got the consultation on the draft policy. You're looking at 2 years' work, I would have thought, before you even start to get that out to driving schools nationally. And then another 18 months, 2 years' work minimum, and the abstractions that go along with it to bring everybody up to that level.
Yeah,
of
it's the abstractions as well, isn't it, like you say?
It is, when you're taking police officers out of their normal duties to train.
Well, we've talked about it previously, haven't we? We were talking about the routine arming of police officers with the training. It's just not feasible.
But as soon as you start turning over the stone, it's not just you responding to grade ones, it's just not your IPP drivers and your advanced drivers going to pursuits. What about surveillance drivers?
Absolutely.
What about armed response drivers who are asked as part of an armed tactic to do an enforced stop on a vehicle? You know, that's a very dangerous tactic.
Well, that's all going to have to be worked out. Even if you decided, if the Home Office got off their keister tomorrow and decided they were going to make it happen, we're still, my estimation, 3 to 4 years away from some effective protection in law.
Anyway, we're getting into that green biro territory,
aren't we?
So that's it for another week.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.